This conference is being recorded.
This is Don Hussig with Cancer Action Network, and you're listening to Loving the Earth Pollution Free Radio. Joining us this morning is Ann Alexander. Ann is an attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council. She's in their Midwestern office. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning.
Great to have you, with us. Describe your work. It is involved with the refineries that are going to be receiving and are already receiving some of the tar sands originating crude. Describe the BP Whiting Refinery Expansion Project.
Sure. We have been very focused here in NRDC's Midwest office generally on these tar sands expansions, the refineries that are expanding so that they can take additional Canadian crude. There are 8 or 9, depending on how you count, slated expansion projects, and we have jumped in to take a hard look at the first couple that have come down the pike. One of those was ConocoPhillips, the Wood River project in Illinois, and we challenged that permit successfully and entered what we consider to be a very favorable settlement with them concerning their air permit. And we are now very focused on the BP Whiting permit that you referenced. The Whiting refinery is one of the largest in North America, even before the expansion to take tar sands. They are essentially changing their refinery's configuration around so that they will, at the end of the project, be able to process 90% Canadian crude at that refinery. Our concern is with what they told the permitting agencies when they were getting this permit, because in order to get an air permit for this kind of a project, you have to add up all of the emissions that are going to be impacted by your project. And if you're shutting things down, you get to offset with those shutdowns. But the bottom line is you've got to show them what the emissions increase or ultimate decrease may be. And our concern is that, well, the long and the short of it is that they cooked the numbers. They did not count nearly all of their sources. There are a lot of disparate sources, moving parts at a refinery, and they just didn't count a lot of really important sources of air pollution. For instance, refineries have big flare stacks. It's what they do with gas from processes that they can't use. It goes up in flames. That's a lot of pollution. They simply didn't count it. They just assumed that they were building 3 big flares and they would never, ever use them. We didn't think that was credible. That's really the tip of the iceberg. I could go on, but that's the gist of it.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds like you focused upon the perfect project here. So how's it going?
Well, so far so good. We are fighting it on 3 fronts, essentially. We have a challenge to the permit in Indiana. It's an administrative forum. And right now, the status of that is it's on summary judgment motions, which means the parties have asked the court on some or all the issues. I mean, it's different among the parties to decide some issues on the papers, so the court is looking at those. In addition to that, we submitted what's called a petition for objections to US EPA, which means on one of the 2 permits that they got for this project, there is a process in the Clean Air Act where we can go to EPA and say, we really think you need to take a second look at this because there are some major problems. And we've sent it up to EPA asking they take that second look, and they're in the process of responding to that. And then finally, we have a federal court suit pending because we believe that what's really at the end of the day going on is that they're building a project that needed a permit for what's called a major source. That's the kind of permit that you have to get when you're significantly increasing your emissions. They're claiming, based on what we think are cooked numbers, that they're actually reducing their emissions, and that's the basis for a federal court suit.
Yeah, sounds good. So you're going to be doing a full-blown Clean Air Act lawsuit.
Yes.
Sounds really cool. Yeah, we certainly want to keep up to date on, how that's, turning out for NRDC. What is known about the emissions of refining tar sands crude?
Well, not as much as we would like. The long and the short of it is we do know that tar sands crude has a lot more sulfur, about 3 times as much sulfur in it as what they call conventional crude. That sulfur is ultimately going to go up the stack. It's going to result in additional pollution. Now, there are ways that one can try to control that. One of our concerns is that the refineries aren't trying to do that. Rather than control the additional sulfur in the way we think they need to, they're essentially trying to count it away or not address it in their air pollution permits, and that's really a problem. In addition to that, it is likely on average that tar sands crude contains more metals, toxic metals, than other types of crude. Unfortunately, we don't know nearly as much about this as we would like because the information out there is sparse. Much of it is essentially treated as confidential industry information. In other words, it's not out there for the public. There are a few studies that are out there that suggest that there are significantly more metals in the tar sands crude, but the long and the short of it is we just don't have complete information.
Well, then how did the bad guys, how did BP Whiting make any kind of estimate about what their emissions are going to be?
Well, that's part of the problem that we're addressing, is that in many cases, they gave extremely partial information. Partial would really be sort of a charitable term for it, to the agency, and the agency essentially accepted that without asking any questions, really, about where they got the information, what exactly they looked at, why they didn't use additional information that was available. They really just kind of gave it a pass, and that's our concern.
Sounds like the same story that I'm hearing. I've been contacting EPA trying to find out what the, you know, what kind of data exists on the emissions of refining tar sands crude, and EPA says they have no data. You know, just as open about it as can be, we have no data. That's what they said. So they were thinking about putting out some requests to industry to begin gathering some data, but they have none right now. They sent me to Canada so that I should talk to one of the, you know, the environmental protection people in Canada, and they gave me a phone number and a name, and I called there numerous times. Never heard a squeak out of them. They're not sharing this information in any kind of reasonable way.
Well, and the bottom line is, I can't obviously speak for Canada, but they may not know either, because unfortunately the Canadian government has been really kind of missing in action in the tar sands development. It's very much the Wild West out there. Development is happening at such a fast pace that it's even making many of the locals uncomfortable, but it's a runaway train. Nobody's really stopping it.
Yeah, I guess all that big money, just does as it pleases anywhere on Earth. And I think in particular in Canada, because I'm starting to, I love Canada, but it's not because of their government. I love Canada because it's this beautiful place of lots and lots of wonderful wilderness. And from what, I've learned about tar sands recently, and there were other kind of warning signs along the way, their laws, there seem like this, like the most, for example, the most ineffective part of New York State DEC's regulation, this Part 211, this prohibition of emissions, well, that's the best law that Canada has. So, just unreal how crappy their EPA, their Environmental Protection Act, is basically this prohibition of emissions similar to this 211, part of New York State DEC's regulations, something that DEC never even tries to enforce. Canada has that as their best law. It shows this huge difference between the U.S. and Canada as far as, regulations and laws that, protect the environment. But anyways,
I was just going to say, both the laws are weaker and the enforcement is weaker. There really is not a strong will to enforce. And most of the enforcement authority, with a few exceptions, is vested in the province. And Alberta has really shown no interest in stepping up to the plate to regulate.
I wonder why Canada is so much more, what gives, why is Canada so much worse on environmental protection than the U.S.?
I can't speak to that question globally, but with respect to tar sands development, I will say I don't know that it's immediately apparent to everyone in the U.S. the extent to which Canada has really emerged as a petrostate. And petrostates are primarily interested in economic development of their resources, and environmental protection does tend to fall by the wayside. And Canada's economy right now is very dependent on its crude development. It's just a huge part of their national product.
Wow. Doesn't sound good for Canadians for a long time. Maybe they're kind of just, I was actually thinking one time, not that long ago, that Canada was ascending and that maybe they were going to someday be this beautiful new world power that kind of rivaled the U.S. But now it's just, it looks like they're descending with this tar sands problem that they've got going. Getting back to the emissions of the tar sands, what is NRDC's, you've touched on this a bit, but let's really spell it out clearly and just get it all nailed down. Perfectly. What is your purpose in litigating against the issuance of the air pollution permit there at BP Whiting?
Well, specifically in this litigation against Whiting, our goal is very straightforward. We want them to do the permitting right. We want them to go back and count all of the emissions at the refinery, not just some of them, not overestimate their decreases or underestimate their increases, but do it right. We think if they do it right, they're going to come out with a significant increase in emissions resulting from the project. And under U.S. law, when you have a significant increase in emissions, you have to put on the most stringent types of technology available. The term for it is best available control technology. And what you're supposed to do is look around the country, find the best of what's being done out there, and do it at your facility. And that's what we think they need to do.
Okay. So I think they're going to be looking at California, right? They seem to be
Yes, California has a lot of the best standards.
Okay. Well, I hope you guys can get them looking in that direction and then, you know, make them do what they see out there. As far as this project, will this BP Whiting project increase the SO2 and lead emissions of that refinery?
We believe it will, but again, that issue is a little bit murky because all we know is that they did the math wrong. We have, as best we can, done the math ourselves and come up with what we believe are significant increases in some of these important pollutants. But the bottom line is it really needs to be sent back to the state agency so that their engineers can work with BP's engineers and do it right and quantify what the increase is.
Well, tell me, why didn't the state agency engineers do it right the first time?
Well, it's a difficult question for me to answer, not being inside their heads. I will say that it appears from the outside to be an old story of economic development essentially blinding people to the need to look at the environmental impacts, which we find problematic, not just in the sense that it's a violation of law, but also I think that what's being missed by those who are thinking narrowly about the issue is that many of the types of measures we're calling for would create jobs. There's this assumption that all we want to do is stop economic development. Now, the fact of the matter is we have serious problems with tar sands development. We think that there are far better sources of energy out there that should be used rather than Canadian crude, which is really kind of the bottom of the barrel in terms of energy. But just looking within the four corners of this permit challenge, if we get what we want, there will be jobs created. If you control the flares and you control the coker emissions and everything else that we're looking at, that requires people. It requires people to construct this equipment, people to monitor the flares. There are jobs created, not lost, by environmental compliance.
Sounds like, you know, you guys are looking at this, you know, in the big picture way. And I think for these other people, they truly just get stuck in the pockets of these, with their hands in the pockets, actually, of these certain parts of the economy. And then they don't look for the other sources of income because, you know, they don't have their connections, I guess. These guys are probably all connected to the big oil companies. Who knows?
Well, philosophically, I was just going to say that I think that we're all a little bit stuck in the paradigm of the false choice between economics and the environment, and that really is not how the world functions anymore. But everyone has in their head the paradigm of it's either the jobs or the owls from 20 years ago, and it's just not how things work anymore.
Yeah. Right here. Extraction, upgrading, and refining the tar sands is causing tremendous, you know, huge, beyond huge, environmental damage in Canada and the U.S. Can tar sands be used as an energy source without large negative impacts on water and air quality?
I believe in never say never, but if there is a way to do it, I have not seen it, and I am not aware of it. As I, you know, mentioned before, tar sands, from my standpoint, are really scraping the bottom of the barrel, no pun intended, in energy. And it kind of reminds me of an addict hitting bottom. There really is no way that I am aware of to develop them without some environmental damage. Now, is there a way to do it more cleanly than it's being done? Undoubtedly. For instance, right now, one of the huge problems up there is that they're taking their mining tailings, which is essentially the part that's left over that you don't want, and simply dumping them in ponds. And they, of course, claim that those ponds are watertight. Well, ponds are never watertight, and the mercury and some other contaminants are leaching right into the Athabasca River, which is flowing downstream into the First Nations communities who are being poisoned by it. That has got to stop. In the first instance, if they're going to develop this, they they have to find a way not to poison the downstream communities and all of the biota that are affected by it. Beyond that, I am sure that focusing on it, on the issue, would result in additional ways being developed to clean up the process. But the bottom line is it is never going to measure up to the environmental standard met by other better sources of energy that we should be turning to.
There you go. There you go. That's something that everybody should think about. In talking about this, I keep, coming, I think of something, then we think of something else, and I just kind of drift away. But then I keep coming back to it. And this question, I have to ask you this question. Will BP Whiting be receiving bitumen, the dirtiest kind of thing that they can run through pipelines to get it to the U.S. refineries, will they be receiving the bitumen or the synthetic crude? And see, the differential, and I know, but the listeners don't, the differential between the bitumen and the synthetic crude is that some of the refining activity, the upgrading they call it, would have taken place in Canada, where their citizens are breathing the air. More of this concentrated pollution right directly from that source. So has BP Whiting ever made it clear whether their refinery is going to be receiving the bitumen or the syncrude?
It's not 100% clear everything they'll be receiving, but I can say as a general matter that they will be receiving a mix.
So then we don't even know how much of the upgrading is going to take, that getting rid of the main part of the SO2. We don't know how much of the upgrading is going to take place at BP Whiting.
Well, the bottom line is, and there are things that I can't get into because they're based on confidential information from the litigation, but I can just speak as a general matter to the fact that refineries, I don't think, they know as a general matter what sort of mix they're going to be getting. I don't know that any refinery knows from day to day exactly how much of any particular crude they're going to be getting in the year 2012 when this thing is up and running. And that actually is really one of the problems in estimating emissions, is that they have made very favorable assumptions for them in terms of their emissions about what sorts of crude they will be receiving, but they're not really accounting for the fact that the metals content and other chemical aspects of the crude really vary widely, even from field to field. I mean, you can say you're receiving it from this general region, say the Christina Lake or the Cold Lake region of Alberta, but there are lots of fields within that, and the content of the crude is going to vary among those fields, and some may have much higher mercury content than others. And those are things that are unknown, and until we know them, it's our position that they need to make worst-case scenario estimates and not best-case scenario estimates.
That's only fair. That's just reasonable. They just don't want to be reasonable. They just want to cheat like they always have. I don't believe it's going to turn out well for them going that route, because certainly environmental awareness has grown in the U.S. and hopefully in Canada too. Certainly there are more people getting focused on preventing some of the diseases that are caused by the pollution and the exposure to these pollutants that, say, for example, with our group, Cancer Action New York and Cancer Action Network, we're really focusing on cancer, and we just find more people every day that are focusing on cancer and are not happy that their relatives died of cancer or have cancer or that they themselves have cancer. Is there any kind of thing that you can share with us about the kind of the communities in the vicinity of the BP Whiting expansion project? Are these people concerned about cancer as one of the problems that has lain upon their path?
It is very hard to read what's happening in the communities. Certainly, it's fair to say that BP has not endeared itself to its neighbors, particularly with incidents like the benzene leak that occurred earlier this year. At the same time, there are many who are economically dependent on the refinery. And unfortunately, both BP and, from our standpoint, the state have done a good job from their standpoint of drumming up fear that if there is any interference from groups like us with the refinery project, that people will lose their jobs, that the economy in the region will suffer. When we went to the hearing on this permit a year ago, March, it was really almost a kind of frightening scene, because BP had done a really good job of turning out the labor unions who had, as far as I could tell, been told that we were the enemy and that we were out to take their jobs. And it really had the feel of almost a sports rally. There were about 1,400 people who turned out in the auditorium essentially to cheer the permit. And the state officials there, I think it's fair to say, were bordering on acting like cheerleaders for the permit. So it's really hard to tell what the real sentiment is because so much false fear has been drummed up and some water has gone under the bridge, like this benzene leak, since they got their permit. So it's really hard to call how people are feeling about it now, but I'm sure it's a mix if you were to do a survey.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds like they're playing some dirty tricks to some degree, you know, with some they're looking at the numbers and they, boy, I never heard of something like turning out the labor unions like that. We've had our scuffles with industry around the New York State up here, and I'm not familiar with anything like that having ever happened. I guess everybody just keeps improving their ability to fight their fight, and I guess we'll have to expect, you know, these types of things to turn out. I'm really hoping that, you know, they don't get that into that kind of strategies and tactics up here in New York State, because, you know, our groups are not as, my group anyways, is not as big and powerful as your group, and I don't know how excited I'd be about turning up at a hearing where there were 1,400 people that didn't like me and were, I'm kind of excited about it. So.
Well, I will say on the upside that progress has been made lately in our region with what's known as the Blue-Green Alliance. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's essentially it's an alliance between green groups, environmental groups, labor unions, labor forces. And the local groups in Indiana that we work with on this issue have been meeting together with the labor unions, and I think a lot of positive, positive alliances have come out of that. So I'm really hoping that, I think now that the labor unions are talking to the green groups, there will be some progress made in understanding that we're really not the enemy. We understand the need for jobs as much as anyone else, and we think that our way to develop jobs is probably in the long run much more effective than wringing the last drops out of a resource that is ultimately going to go away anyway.
Yeah, it's so disappointing to see people look at environmental activists as enemies. I've had that treatment plenty of times, and I know exactly what you're talking about. And I've been thinking along these lines of this kind of this enemies of the people kind of thing. That's what it's really kind of being cast as. And truly, in my way of thinking, thinking about, you know, just other enemies of the people. I was just this morning thinking about the fact that Bin Laden, 2,000 people that were killed by Al-Qaeda at the, on 9/11? Was it 2000?
That's something like that.
Yeah. And then we think about dioxin exposure here in the U.S., you know, that's coming from activities that Americans engage in, coming from the food supply that is contaminated with dioxins, and EPA is estimating that approximately 200,000 Americans in their lifetime, say 70 years, about a 70-year lifetime, 200,000 Americans will die in that 70 years of dioxin exposure, cancer, caused by dioxin exposure. Now, you know, just thinking about that, our environmental group has been trying so hard to get the dioxins out of the food supply so that those 200,000 people won't die sooner or later in some 70 years in the future. That 200,000, if Bin Laden had, if Al-Qaeda was blowing up buildings and killing that many people every year, they wouldn't even come close to those numbers in 70 years. It'd only be about, I think it was 140,000, something like that. You know, just not that number. And, you know, just, it's unreal what we're doing to ourselves, and yet the environmentalists are trying to stop that, and yet we're the enemies of the people. It's really, really crazy thinking, you know, this going on.
Well, we live in a very fear-based culture these days. And when people are fearful, they're not terribly rational, and they tend to focus their fear on a perceived outside enemy, rather than looking at enemies that are a little bit harder to identify and risks that are a little bit hard to understand. People will tend to latch on to something that is clearer, that can be more clearly identified as a threat and that isn't coming essentially from the inside. It's an outside threat. We can fear Bin Laden because he's other. But people are often reluctant to look at things closer to home.
Yeah, so they do themselves. And I admit, it's more complicated. It's much more complicated to understand how dioxins get in the food supply and how we get exposed to them and how much cancer risk is related to that. It's just such a bigger picture, more difficult thing to grasp, but it's still just as real. It's still just as many people, you know, more people dying. And it's as unnecessary also, because there are things that our government can do to reduce dioxins in the food supply. There's things that every individual person can do that has their trash to dispose of and chooses not to burn it in their barrel and their or in their refuse heap on their farm. So, we're really hoping that the environmentalists will soon not be looked on as these bad guys, but as actually these real good guys.
Well, yeah, and I think that more and more stories come out of environmentalists who are moms, who are parents, who are fighting for their kids, who were not concerned until they saw harm that was done to their children. And that is increasingly something that you see in environmental circles. There are battles being fought by locals who just want to protect their families.
Yep, that's the bottom line. Yeah, that's what we think about. We think about when we do our cancer prevention education, we say, what would we want to tell our daughters, our sons, our mothers, our brothers, our sisters? What do you tell people you love, And our message is very different than the message that government gives out on cancer prevention. They just talk about cigarette smoking and alcohol and body weight and, a diet with not a word about what's in the diet, the pollution, the pesticides, the dioxins, the PCBs, all these various persistent chemicals in the diet. So we tell people the whole story. We tell them about the cigarette smoking. We tell them about, the body weight. But we tell them about the pollution in the food. And that's what we tell people that we love, and that's what I do tell people I love. And so, we're just taking this different approach to education than government seems to be taking these days. A couple more questions about the BP Whiting Project. Does the Clean Air Act, and this is a more general question really, but it applies to BP Whiting, does the Clean Air Act protect communities against additional pollution in situations where air quality is already considerably degraded by pollution?
Well, yes, it does in the general sense, in that with respect to what they call the criteria pollutants, which are sort of a basic set of very problematic pollutants, communities, or I should say regions, not really individual communities, are categorized as either being in attainment or in non-attainment. And if they're not in attainment, then there are much more stringent standards that apply to permitting. For instance, if you're going to increase pollution in a non-attainment area for a particular pollutant, then you have to get offsets. In other words, things that are going to be shut down to offset your additional pollution. If there is attainment, essentially all you need to show is that you are not going to threaten to put the region out of attainment for that particular pollutant. There are issues having to do with you have to measure what increment of the remaining clean air you're going to be using, but it's a different standard.
Okay. Tell me, is BP Whiting, is that project in attainment or non-attainment for any of these pollutants?
It's in non-attainment for some pollutants, attainment for others. It's a mix.
Okay.
And yes, it's our position that if they claim not to be increasing their emissions, but if in fact they're increasing their emissions for a non-attainment pollutant, then they have some pretty stringent measures they need to take.
That described as a layer, this lowest achievable emission releases,
emission
something like
rate,
that?
Right, and then offsets.
Yeah, hopefully they'll. I'm thinking that if it'll be a totally different project if they're actually required to fulfill the letter of the law on this, and it's only for everybody's good. Like you're saying, that there's not necessarily an economic loss. The people are not going to be exposed to as much pollution that causes cancer and causes some of these other chronic diseases and non-chronic diseases. It's just unreal what we're learning from the science of all the diseases that are caused by pollution. Let's see, one more quick question, and we're going to wrap this up. What about the pipelines? The pipelines are bringing this product, this dirty Canadian solution to our fuel uses. They're bringing that here from Canada. There's lots of them. They're going lots of different places. They're going to many different refineries and regions of the U.S. Can you tell us a little bit about these pipelines?
I can tell you in general terms. I have not personally worked on the pipeline issue, but I do know that there has been some concern from the communities through which the pipelines are planned about how well those pipelines will be maintained. Are they going to leak, and who's going to be responsible if they leak? Some farmers are concerned that their fields are being bisected, which is, of course, a serious economic problem for a farmer. I do not know that anyone has yet been successful in a legal challenge to these pipelines. I do know that there are legal challenges like that out there and pending. And I do know that there is some significant unease among the people whose land would be used. that's been taken by eminent domain.
Well, there just seems like to be no end to the problem that this tar sand thing is causing. And I just always think about my beloved Saskatchewan. I just love that place so much. It's so beautiful. And when I hear people saying that, you know, they're getting most of the acid from the upgrading that is taking place out there in Alberta, and that, you know, there's no real controls on air pollution in Alberta, so poor Saskatchewan is just getting dumped on by not only the acid, but these metals and these various other air pollutants that are emitted by tar sands, the PAHs, lots of sooty kind of dirty combustion processes and these various industrial processes going on out there with regards to tar sands. You know, it's I just feel like hopefully this is going to all kind of just grow and become more powerful. And I believe in shutting the tar sands down. You know, that's, there's some groups that want to just, like, say, fix it and get it to be as good as it can be and then, you know, do it, or a moratorium and not such fast growth. I believe, you know, my heart cries out for stop tar sands, and I'm hoping that's going to be the way this all turns out. And you guys are certainly doing a beautiful thing there, helping the people in the Midwest better understand, you know, what's at stake as far as, you know, the damages to their water and air, you know, from these refinery expansions that are the only way that tar sands can go is with these refinery expansions. I hope everybody's kind of keeping track of that.
Well, first and foremost, we believe in compliance with law. We think that these refineries have to do what the Clean Air Act requires. They're not doing it now, and that's what we're going to fight for.
Sounds good. Well, thank
okay,
you very
well,
much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Ann. Hope you have a great day, and, you know, go after them. Good. Good
okay,
luck.
Okay, thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.